everybody, and welcome back to Thank Godzilla. It's Friday. It's Friday. And that means it's Godzilla. My name is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic. I write for The Wrap. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. I write for Slash Film.
You sure do.
I do. I write a lot.
Oh, yeah.
It took a half day today. Still wrote a bunch of articles.
You ever write about Godzilla?
Less than you might think.
Yeah, I imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, Slash Film is what they call an SEO factory. They just sort of farm for clicks and
well, it's what they're going after. Being popular right now.
Exactly. So, they're constantly chasing the trends. So unless Godzilla is like in the consciousness already,
I mean, there's a movie coming out in a month.
I suppose so.
Yeah.
Nobody cares about that one.
How Godzilla has a best friend nobody talks about anymore.
You mean Anguirus?
Anguirus, his canonical best friend. And it's just, nobody talks about Anguirus. Where's Anguirus? It's like, it would be like if, like, I'm trying to think of, like, a good, like, sort of friend parry. It's like, oh, we're going to do an Abbott and Costello movie. Mm. We don't need Costello. It's just Abbott. He's not gonna come up. In fact, we're gonna write him out of canon.
Welcome to Bill's Excellent Adventure.
Right? It's weird, right? But for some reason with Godzilla, we've let it go. Anyway, this is our Godzilla podcast here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. We're watching every single Godzilla and Godzilla adjacent movie. We tried to do it in order. That fell apart a few times because we missed some obscure stuff, but we're trying to be thorough when we think that's important. But we are in the middle of the Millennium Era, which is a weird era for a couple of reasons. As we've already discussed, the last Godzilla movie we reviewed, Godzilla 2000, was a hard reboot. Boom.
The original
was canon and then nothing else. And ordinarily, after you reboot something, especially if another movie comes along like a year later, that's starting a new canon, right? It would be weird if, like, Quantum of Solace was a different James Bond canon than Casino Royale after you went to all that effort.
And this is the worst thing about the Millennium Era.
Yeah, the inconsistency.
It's the same Godzilla, same suit, same design, same Godzilla actor.
Yeah.
But it fast forwards in time. This one takes place in the near future.
Right. But it's not the near future of Godzilla 2000. It's not like a couple of years later. Mm. This is Godzilla 2000. It has some similar things going for it.
If you really, really wanted to believe, you
can maybe make it work. But they do have some similarities in common. Both films sort of take the original Godzilla as vague or specific backstory, except Godzilla didn't die at the end. Mm-hmm. In fact, Godzilla vs. Mechagodzilla, which is what we're reviewing today, opens with some footage from the original, but they have shot new footage, or I don't know if they superimposed the new Godzilla suit on the old classic Gojira footage to sort of create that through line. In Godzilla 2000, one thing that they had talked, and Godzilla had like sort of hovered around this before, but Godzilla 2000 started to make it some kind of canon, that Godzilla was making landfall to destroy like nuclear power plants.
Yeah.
It was specifically what he was mad at.
Drawn to power sources and trying to wipe it out.
Yeah. In Godzilla,
Which is thematically sort of counter to what Godzilla was born from. Godzilla was born of radiation, as we saw in the Heisei era.
Yeah.
Godzilla was deliberately created. He was no longer a remnant of war.
After about halfway through that Heisei era, but yes, exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, they were kind of...
They realized they needed a Godzilla, whoopsie doodle, we had to make him again.
So Godzilla was like a deliberate creation by the Japanese government to serve as like an enforcer.
A little
bit more of a good guy trying to absolve Godzilla of a lot.
You're giving, I think, the humans a little too much credit for having a good plan there when it was really just kind of flying by our seat of our pants, doing the best we can.
Point being, that Godzilla, and from then on, because it was the same continuity, was no longer a leftover from World War II. And
it was a nuclear sub that did it, but yeah.
The symbol of what Godzilla represents changed entirely.
Oh, great. Oh, I agree. Yeah. And I think that changes over time. And I think it's changed now, too, because
Godzilla is an agent of nature who is trying to destroy nuclear power.
Yeah.
And how dangerous it is.
And listen...
And this was prior to Fukushima, like, quite a number of... about a decade.
The, any character that has a long, long life and means something to multiple generations... Mm. Needs to be at least a little malleable.
Mm.
Needs to have, you know, some flexibility so that they can relate to people whose sensibilities might be different, the frame of references might be different. Superman has changed dramatically. You read the original stories. Very different character from who he was in the 50s. Very different character from who he was in the 80s. Very different character from who he was in the Snyder era. They're all Superman, but they all have different vibes. So Godzilla's going to have different vibes. That's great. I love that. And honestly, the idea that Godzilla has a motive is interesting because I feel like in the Showa era, later he became more of like a self-appointed Earth's protector type, which is fine.
Yeah.
But we discovered in, I think it was Ghidorah, the three-headed monster, when Mothra was trying to recruit Rodan and Godzilla to fight King Ghidorah. And this is still one of my favorite scenes in the whole series. When Mothra's like, we have to save the world. And Godzilla's like, why? We're trying to mind our own goddamn business. And they keep bullying us. Let us go. Like, I'm not attacking anybody. I'm just shuffling around. It's not my fault I'm this big. I'm elaborating. He didn't say all of that. Mm. But that's the implication was they were kind of uninterested in us. We just were in the way when they were stomping around.
Yeah.
They weren't angry. I think in Gojira, it's definitely more allegorical, and there's definitely a sense that Godzilla is some kind of sort of vengeance. But after that, after that Godzilla died, the next Godzilla had a wholly different vibe. So now we have a Godzilla who is specifically arriving whenever Japan, specifically Japan, gets a new form of energy. So we see in like the 50s and 60s, it attacks nuclear power plants. Boom, 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 boom.
And there's flashback footage. And then they say in, and I don't know the significance of this, but in 1966, they move the capital of Japan from Tokyo to Osaka.
Yeah, I'm actually curious, like, if there's, like, something to that that is more than just creating an interesting sort of side continuity. I mean, I guess if he's constantly destroying, you know, this one city, maybe we should move the capital to another one. I guess that would make sense.
Yeah.
It would be like if your city was eroding, you might want to move, you know, like it's going to fall into the ocean, you know.
But I don't know what... Because I know Osaka is like, it's like the business city. Like I think it's like considered the economic capital of Japan.
We are not experts in Japan or Japanese culture, and we do not pretend to be. We're coming at this from a Western perspective.
So if someone would like to write in and tell us, you know, what the significance is, like what would it say about Japan that they moved the capital to Osaka from Tokyo?
Yeah. Is there a greater significance to that other than just world building?
An American film, like, say, our capital is Washington, D.C. What if they moved it to Los Angeles?
Right.
That would imply, wait a minute.
What happened to Washington? Yeah.
Either something happened to Washington or L.A., the things L.A. is obsessed with, i.e. show business and money, became more important to the American people.
There would definitely be a symbolic element to it. Yeah. That it moved to Los Angeles instead of New York City instead of
Houston, Texas, or Mobile, Alabama.
That means something now. Mobile, Alabama is not like the center of power in America. So yeah, that's something that we don't have a great beat on, so we're not going to focus on that, but it is of interest. And then the timeline starts to divert more and more, and because Godzilla keeps destroying power plants every time Japan makes them, but because it is also the 20th century and industrialization and cars and all sorts of different technological advancements are still driving the world and the economy, they need power. So they keep trying to come up with new things to do to solve Japan's power needs while not incurring the wrath of Godzilla. And in the 90s, they develop a new kind of power source. It's a plasma generated power source, totally made up, but we're in sci-fi territory. And they're going to...
And that was like in the mid-90s. Yeah, they came up with this plasma energy source. So they're
very excited about this. This is going to be the problem. This is going to solve all of our problems. And it's not nuclear. Godzilla will not have a problem with it. Bum, 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 bum.
So, low and hop, skip, and a jump later, even plasma is banned.
Yeah.
And now Japan is working on black hole energy.
Well, it's not really working on black hole energy so much as it is working on a way to kill Godzilla so they can just get some fucking energy.
Yeah.
The idea that Japan is hurting in its energy needs is purely academic. We don't actually see that. It's yeah, not it's like... It's
Japan
not like,
is not destitute. There's no yeah, shots of
there's no rolling blackouts, like, all over the place. It seems like it's doing okay. It's like, I don't know why we're... They even say in the movie, like... No, wait. Our main character is named Kiriko. She's a soldier, and in the opening sequence, she's one of many soldiers with, like, basically bazookas. And they're trying to stop Godzilla. A fool's errand, but they gotta try.
And this was, like, in the 90s.
This is in the 90s. So, like, about 5 years before the movie is set. And she's trying to stop Godzilla. She's very motivated to stop Godzilla. And her superior officer, who she has a lot of respect for, dies saving her from a bunch of rubble falling. And she's very, very angry, and she... lifts up the bazooka and goes, ah! And then there's the title. And it's great. But we cut to a few years later, and she is now in charge of... Is it the G-Graspers?
The Godzilla Graspers. Yeah.
Fun name.
And they're like... they're straight out of the movie Aliens. They're the, what are they called? The Colonial Marines.
They're the Colonial Marines and Aliens, yeah. And the idea is she is one of the heads of a... government organization that is specifically designed to do a lot of things with Godzilla. One, detect Godzilla. Two, research Godzilla. Three, perfect evacuation methods when Godzilla shows up. I'm glad they included all of those things. It's not just a murder factory. And then lastly, there's the murder factory where we're trying to come up with a way to destroy Godzilla once and for all. And someone asks her, so if you want to prevent Godzilla from attacking, what if we just don't build any more nuclear power? And she's like, that would work. But if he ever shows up again, we got to figure out how to stop him. And she's not entirely wrong about that. The other main character is a scientist named Kudo. And there's a really weird intro to Kudo.
Well, because he's not a scientist when we meet him.
Well, he's an inventor, but he's not like a professional scientist. And so she's recruiting interesting prospects. And
it's established that like he fell from grace. He was a professional inventor and scientist, and now is reduced to like doing magic tricks.
Or at least a promising one. He's pretty young. So when we meet him, it's the middle of the city. And he's got a couple of kids in front of him, and he's doing a little trick. And he's got all of the ingredients for curry rice. Like, little piles. Like, it's like what you'd feed a mouse. And it's like a magic trick. He takes a bowl, he puts the bowl over the ingredients, waits a few seconds, ta-da, they're all together, and it's a nice little meal. And it's the kid's like, wow, what an amazing trick. And then Kiriko shows up and says, I know how this is done. The bowl is actually a microwave, and inside the bowl, there are little tiny robots that can prepare the meal super fast, and the kids say...
They look like Hex Bugs, if you've ever seen those toys in the toy shop.
And the kids, upon finding out that this guy put a microwave in a bowl and built little tiny robots that are capable of making curry rice, go, well, that's bullshit, I'm leaving. And I'm like, you're not impressed? I'm more impressed. I thought he just switched it out when he put the bowl down. I mean, that's the obvious trick.
Well, it's like I reach into my hat and I pull out a scarf that wasn't in there before, and they look in and it's like, oh, you just had an interdimensional rabbit.
Yeah,
like open up a portal. That's you cheated.
Like
no,
that doesn't impress you. How does that not impress you?
I want to meet the interdimensional rabbit.
That sounds amazing. Yeah. So it's a weird intro, but it establishes that. He's a ahead of his time inventor, which will be important later. But, yeah, they're bringing him into a project because they have an idea for a new weapon. And they think that this weapon will finally be able to destroy Godzilla once and for all. And the weapon is a mini black hole.
Yeah, they can fire a black hole at Godzilla.
Yeah.
Suck Godzilla into the black hole, but it's small enough that it won't, like, suck up light out of the atmosphere.
It'll collapse on itself pretty quick. I guess there's, like, a time limit on that. But now, it's, like, 2 meters long. Yeah, that's the plan.
You know what a black hole is, right?
I do know what a black hole is. It's a collapsed star. Yeah. It is something that is
infinitely dense. Yeah.
Like, I think a black hole of any size could potentially destroy the planet. Mm. Like, okay.
It's a vacuum tube. They can suck Godzilla into a big vacuum cleaner.
I will throw it out to you that we also have a Godzilla in this movie, so I'm going to cut it some slack. But it is one of the sillier ideas we've seen in a while.
I don't know why I had it in my head that the Heisei era was, like, light and kind of fun, and the Millennium era was, like, dark and strange, because the Millennium era is, like,
pretty goofy so far.
Stupider.
Like the Heisei era had some weird shit in it, but there was always this, like...
There was at least Mickey was in there, and there was a through line.
Well, Mickey was in there, and that she was a through line. I wish they'd done more with her, honestly. She's one of my favorite characters we've ever encountered, but... There was always this, like, layer of severity, of global oppression, and it really did feel like Godzilla was an apocalyptic threat constantly, and thanks to Godzilla 2000, which there are parts of it that are probably outside of their control, the budget doesn't look great, the visual effects weren't there yet, but frankly, it's a silly film.
Yeah.
There are parts in this movie that I think you can take seriously in Godzilla vs. Megaguirus, but mostly we're here to have fun. Mm. It's not a goofy childlike fun. It's more of adolescent sort of sci-fi TV series kind of fun. Because we've got this team. They're going to team up to destroy Godzilla. There's a little romantic tension between Kiriko and Kudo. Not a lot, but it's there. Mm. It's giving them a little bit more personality. He's a sort of... like a fun layabout kind of guy, you know, he's very brilliant, but he's also not one on, like, rules or discipline. And she's very big on rules and discipline. She takes her job very, very seriously. And so, like, they're the original Odd Couple. If at the end of the Odd Couple, you thought they were going to date, which, by the way, let's make that movie. Why not? Jesus. So they build this device, and they call, what do they call it? They call it the Dimension Tide.
Oh, what is it called? Yeah,
yeah, I think it's Dimension Tide.
The Dimension Tide.
Yeah, yeah, which has a nice poetry to it. Honestly, I'm not sure how accurate a translation that is, but it's a cool name.
Yeah, the Dimension Tide. Mm. And they test it out, they fire it, and a bug comes out.
Yeah, very, 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 very The Fly. Because they test it out in the middle of, like, a forest, and notably, there's a small child who lives nearby, and he didn't know they were doing this test, and he kind of wanders into it, and he's just sort of staring at it. He's not really important, but they do spend a lot of time with him, and they blow up a building, and it's like, hey, it worked. This is great. Now all we have to do is put it in space, and I'm like... okay, sure, let's put it in space. Why not? That'll make you happy.
I understand the thinking. It's like, we need it in space because it orbits the Earth, and it
could attack Godzilla anywhere, theoretically.
Godzilla makes landfall anywhere on the planet, we could be able to take care of it. It's not happened where Godzilla hasn't attacked Japan specifically.
Yeah, so you can probably
Godzilla hangs around Japan. You kind of have a good...
Yeah, you have a general sense of...
area to aim at.
Yeah, yeah, there's that. And there's also, then they never really talk about this. This is possibly the greatest weapon of mass destruction ever conceived. Literally even conceived. You just want to put it up in space? You just want it just to hover all over us like the Sword of Damocles? What are we doing here?
I feel like a lot of movies that came out in between the fall of the Berlin Wall and 9/11.
Yeah.
That is the 90s.
Mostly, yeah.
It was a time, at least in the United States, of a lack of war. There weren't active conflicts.
There were. Oh, there was Bosnia. There was, you know, there was...
Not that American troops were on the ground for, is my point.
There were, actually. Right. I mean, you ever see Black Hawk Down? I mean, there were these were not, like, formal wars on, like, the scale in which we might think. But, like, we were in armed conflict constantly. It just wasn't, like...
Well, we constantly are. We didn't name the war as much,
you know? Like, it wasn't... it wasn't...
The Cold War was over, is my point.
Yes, that part is true, yes.
And when the military was depicted in the movies of the 1990s, it was it tended to be kind of a satire of Reagan era policies.
A lot of it, yeah.
So, and you know, Reagan had the whole Star Wars thing. We're going to put weapons in space and shoot down missiles. That's going to work. Yeah. And it worked really well.
Or it's like satirizing that. Or it's like about the aftermath. Like, after the Cold War, what are you good for?
Yeah.
There was a lot of that in the 90s.
There's like a lot of, you know, there were a lot of stories in the 90s about like bitter Soviets who are trying to amass old weapons. Like, we got to keep the old ways going, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Couldn't think of any new villains for a while, so we just kept falling back on that.
Kept doing the Soviets, even after the Soviet Union was no longer.
James Bond was really struggling with that. Like, oh, God, who's the new villain for the modern age? I don't know. Journalists? What?
Steve Jobs?
Well, I mean, it was Rupert Murdoch, basically. It was the bad guy in Tomorrow Never Dies, which admittedly has aged well, aspect of it.
I feel like they should have ended James Bond with GoldenEye. Because I love.
I mean, it would have been a good spot.
I love GoldenEye. It's like, we're going to reboot GoldenEye, and Pierce Brosnan is my favorite James Bond. I'm the only person who feels that way.
Oh,
but,
no, I think there's a great argument to be made. I think he was the best James Bond who only had one good movie. Like, Tomorrow Never Dies is okay.
GoldenEye is good. Tomorrow Never Dies is okay.
It's okay.
The World Is Not Enough is half a good movie.
No,
it's not. And Die Another Day is trash.
It's enjoyable trash, but it is trash. No, I think GoldenEye is just like the one solid one he did. Yeah, Tomorrow Never Dies is close, but it's not great.
But the whole point of GoldenEye was the Cold War is over. We still have, like, echoes from the Cold War kind of going through. Because that was an ex-Soviet story. It came out in 95.
Yeah. We have all this shit lying around. What are we going to do? We got to do something with it.
And I liked the idea that James Bond's job is now just to clean that up.
Yeah.
It's like, you have one last use, but you're kind of on the way out now.
Yeah, they called him a dinosaur in that movie. Yeah,
to his face. It's, which, fine.
Yeah.
Let's just leave him there. The Cold War's over. We don't need him anymore.
Yeah.
But I feel like a lot of... A view of the military at the time was either the X-Files, which was paranoia about the military attacking America.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's some sort of
just
shadowy,
the government in general.
The
government
is, like, shadowy
us.
And
yeah.
secretive and is working against you. They're the enemy now. Our own government is now the enemy.
Yeah.
Or it's like in Godzilla, where we're just going to invent super weapons and have this badass stuff because that's kind of what the dream of the 80s was, and we're going to make fun of that a little bit. We're just going to, like, blow it up a little bit.
I mean, yeah, I guess so.
Like,
but,
expand the Star Wars system into something science fiction-y, even though it's completely absurd. So, yes, it's a big weapon of mass destruction, but it's not based in any kind of need to destroy an enemy or any kind of paranoia.
Yeah.
It's trying to take that gung-ho, military-first attitude of the Reagan era and just make it look big and ridiculous.
I mean,
it's almost like a comment on itself. I feel like a lot of media of the 90s was a comment on itself.
There's also that, but I think there's also... it's not always necessarily thoughtful, and I think a lot of people were just going through the motions because it looked cool.
Mm-hmm.
Aliens, which you've mentioned is a bit of an influence here, I think I saw a bigger influence in of Aliens in Destoroyah. There's definitely a sequence right out of Aliens in that movie. But Aliens is one of the most influential movies in terms of science fiction. Every action movie, sci-fi movie after Aliens, like, probably owes Aliens a bit of a debt. I mean, we wouldn't have Halo, like, as a video game without Alien. Like, the Alien, specifically Aliens, the James Cameron one. The idea of space marines fighting monsters, Warhammer 40K. These are all things that, like, Aliens kind of set this template for, much like Blade Runner set the template for cyberpunk. You're either consciously choosing to do it, or you're consciously choosing to avoid it. But it's just, or if you're doing a post-apocalyptic thing, are you doing Road Warrior, or do you have a different idea? Those are your two options. It's just the default mode. So they build this device, it works, they're very excited about it, they have to put it up into outer space. There's a little boy, he sees the thing go down, and they find him like, oh, there's a little kid here, and he saw us do this thing. And I'm like, I mean, you didn't see you do anything illegal, the government knows what you're doing, just tell him to shut up and let him go, which they do. I guess Kiriko gives the kid her phone number, because he manages to reach out to her later, but... After that event, and after the government clears out, he finds an egg.
That came
a
through
big
the
egg,
the portal.
Now the movie,
and it's like a frog sack, like it's a sack of eggs.
Yeah. the movie isn't 100% clear on exactly what happened here. The movie makes it seem like there was like a bug got in the way of the machine and got like mutated or something.
No, but it came from another. It's like the mist. It came from another dimension.
It came from another dimension, or it came from the past, because they talk about later about how it's actually an extinct species. In any case, it's here now. It's not supposed to be. This kid, like, adopts it, and it's going to be, like, pod people, Trumpy, you can do magic things kind of situation, except it starts to leak, and he gets really embarrassed, and so he, like, tries to throw it away, and this lady's like, hey, trash day isn't until Thursday, you can't throw anything away, and I'm like, I don't think that's how trash works, but okay. And so the kid just dumps it into the sewer, like in the movie Alligator, and of course, they start growing, multiplying, and turns out there's a whole bunch of them, and they are there's a prehistoric species of dragonfly.
Meganulon.
Yeah, Meganulon. I think there's like two different versions, like one and then it pupates.
Meganulon, then Meganula.
Yeah.
Or in the English language dub, they say Meganula.
Oh, did you see the English language dub? Yeah. I was able to find the original.
Oh, nice.
Okay. It's still translated, so I don't speak Japanese or anything, so I'm going off of the subtitles, but I did see the original. As we've mentioned before, I think we mentioned it last week, this bug is fictional, but that doesn't mean we haven't seen it before. Because this was the bug that was the original fake-out monster in Rodan.
That's right.
If we recall, in Rodan, there's a bunch of miners, they get trapped in a thing, seems like there's a monster down there, and you know it's about a big, giant pterodactyl monster, so you're expecting that to show up, but instead of that, it's a bunch of, like, giant, like, human-sized bugs that initially attack, and it turns out that's just what Rodan eats. There was, like, a kind of, like, a little ecosystem
in there.
Little ecosystem, and also a little bit of a surprise. You know, you think you're going one direction and going another. It works, basically, as long as you don't spend too much time on the first monster. They're back. And now they're taking center stage. And they emerge from the sewers, kind of like the cockroaches in Mimic. And there's a scene, and this scene is gross. Couple, like, is, like, out in the middle of the night. She goes inside to, like, buy something. He's, like, waiting outside in an alley. And there's, like, a bug. Like we see the POV, and the bug, like, jumps on him.
Uh-huh.
And it crushes his head on camera.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Like, straight up gloop. Like, it's just, like, blech. Like straight out of an 80s, straight out of a Hennenlotter movie. Like, it's great. But it's, like, I was not prepared for that much violence because the tone was really kind of light and PG-13 until that exact moment. So that was weird. And then the girl shows up and is like, oh, where'd my boyfriend go? And then she gets brutally murdered as well. Good bit of setup. Good bit of drama. Meanwhile, and this is not explained very well, meanwhile, the city is starting to flood, and it floods up, like, 8 stories. Really fast.
I wasn't sure if that was the city, like, if that was Osaka that was flooding,
uh-huh.
Or was it another, I was under the impression that it was, like, a suburb. Or something that they had deliberately flooded, like in that movie In Dreams, like they flooded a city.
It's not deliberate. People were living there. It's like a disaster. We see them evacuate. So it's clearly not intentional. But I guess it must be because there were monsters in the sewers, but they are really nonspecific about what, why, or how that is happening.
What caused the flooding.
Yeah, but there are these giant monsters, and so they're going to have to deal with the monsters and the flooding. And also Godzilla is back. But why is Godzilla back? We haven't done anything. Is he mad about the black hole device?
He's mad about the black hole device.
Theoretically. We find out more. There's more to it later. also, meanwhile, Kudo and Kiriko have developed kind of a cute relationship, and there's this sequence where she's working out, and he's, like, just trying to talk to her or whatever, and it's like, no, I have no time for social relationships. I only work in Godzilla. And that's when he gives her a tracking bullet. And this bullet goes into, like, a flare gun, and you shoot it, and she tests it out, and she shoots it through, like, a big metal, like, weight.
It's like a, because they have their gym, like their like their workout bench.
And it's important that we know how powerful that gun is, because otherwise, in a few minutes, when that pays off, it's not going to seem plausible if we don't see that it can, like, shoot through metal. But after this whole flood, and after the giant Meganulon are flying around, they get in their really cool spaceship-type ship called the Griffin.
Which is, what was the ship from the Heisei era?
It was
like the X-1, I think.
Yeah, it was like the X-1.
Yeah. It reminded me of it. Like, it doesn't look the same, but it's the same idea, same concept.
Yeah, yeah. They fly out to the ocean to investigate why Godzilla is, like, bubbling up. It looks like Godzilla has attacked one of those monsters that flew out to sea. Also kind of hazy on how that happened and when that happened. And this sequence is fucking awesome, because they land and they're, like, investigating the carcass of this giant bug. And then Godzilla starts to emerge from the waves, and everyone escapes into their helicopter, except Kiriko. Mm-hmm. And Kiriko is there right next to Godzilla. And I love it when you actually put a human being right next to Godzilla for scale. Uh-huh. It just makes it seem so much more epic. And she does something I have wanted someone to do in these movies for so long. She climbs Godzilla. She gets on Godzilla. She's climbing around his scales. It's fucking awesome. Like, more of that, please. How have you resisted the urge? So she's climbing Godzilla. She takes the tracking ball and she shoots it into Godzilla, which will be important later, because they're trying to, like, track him so they can shoot this thing at him. Kiriko also goes after this. She survives, obviously. They have a big presentation in front of the government to say, listen, we need authorization to use the black hole gun against Godzilla. Mm-hmm. And she's very serious, very stern, and very emotional, and they say yes. And so they go to the scientists, and Kudo and the other scientists are like, we don't really know how well it works yet. Like, we tried it once. We don't know how it's going to work from space. The aim might be off. It's not really calibrated. You really kind of threw us under a bus here. And she's like, well, I believe in you. And they're like, well, I guess that'll have to do. That's much better than calibrating this giant weapon of mass destruction that we've built. Thank you. And also, the bugs are starting to, like...
They're molting.
They're molting. There's tons of them. They're starting to, like, pupate. Mm. There's this great shot, very much like the old 50s film, Beginning of the End, where they're just, like, covering the side of a building.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a nice little image right there. That was very, very cool.
And it's CG, but it looks like CG. I mean, we're in the era where a lot of the compositing looked really terrible.
Yeah.
I don't know why films from the early 2000s looked as bad as they do.
Mm. Well, they hadn't figured out the tricks yet, and the technology was evolving. Bugs tended to look better in CG just because they're kind of like...
A little bit more robotic, I guess.
Yeah, they have like these shiny bodies and everything already, so you can kind of get away with it a little bit better than you could if it was like a dog, where you have to worry about fur moving correctly, that kind of thing. So they look pretty good.
Yeah, there's a couple shots of them hatching, and we get to see them grow. They're getting bigger. Godzilla's around. Drawn back to Japan. The bugs start attacking Godzilla and sucking energy out of Godzilla.
Yeah.
They're like mosquitoes.
Yeah, they're
sucking Godzilla blood, which is Godzilla energy, straight out of his body.
Well, what they're doing is they need to bring Godzilla to an island because they're not sure if the device will work underwater. So he needs to be on land. So they try to, like, lure him with their spaceship to this one island, which they think will be safe to use the weapon. And then, but while he's there, all the bugs are there and they swarm him. And he looks really annoyed. It would be like if you just, like, you ever just, like, walk down the street and then all of a sudden you just walk through a cloud of, like, gnats? And you're like, the gnats! So annoying! What's with the silent G? What were you thinking? There's a silent G in gnats.
Oh.
I don't know. Do we need
that?
I'm
so dumb I didn't even register,
That's
though.
That's fine. Right. it's hardly even a joke. It's just sort of like, I always kind of thought that was funny. Anyway, so he's flying up all the killing all the bugs, shooting all the bugs. It's like, bugs, none of these bugs. And they shoot the black hole weapon.
And it kills off a lot of the bugs.
It kills off a lot of bugs, but it misses Godzilla. Like, it doesn't have the effect that they're going for.
It sucks up a lot of the bugs, and Godzilla used... I love the shot of Godzilla just sort of blasting his nuclear breath into, like, a cloud of gnats.
Yeah.
It's like...
like they're on lighting on fire and shit.
Well, I wasn't sure how well that would work. It's like it's like if you're being chased by a swarm of bees, you wouldn't fire a gun.
Yeah.
Like a bullet might hit a bee if you're lucky.
And they're like, okay, we'll fire it again. But it turns out it needs like an hour to cool down. It's not a rapid fire device. So if you miss, you're fucked. So the scene can end and the movie can continue. And the bugs that were like sucking out the radiation from Godzilla, they go back to the flooded city and they swim underground. And there's a really giant one of these things. And it's going to be Megaguirus. Mm. And again, they're a little hazy on exactly the logic of this, but basically they attach itself to the big thing and they give it all a bunch of Godzilla energy and it gets mutated and it wakes up and it's this giant...
It's Megaguirus.
It's Megaguirus. And Megaguirus is basically a giant dragonfly with like a menicing face and sharp teeth.
And a stinger. It's got like a big scorpion-like tail.
Yeah. Honestly, cool monster.
Cool. It's a cool monster.
Very cool monster.
Practical effect. There's an actor in there, which is pretty
sometimes,
cool.
Sometimes, yeah. Not always, but yeah.
I mean, not for, like, the flying scenes, but yeah, there's an actor in there.
Yeah.
And the big showdown is going to be between Godzilla and Megaguirus.
Yeah.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
The fight goes on a long time.
It's a long fight.
It's a long fight, but there's a lot of variety in the fight.
It's one of the better fights I think we've ever had, actually, because there's...
The camera's back. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of wide angles. It's shot during the day.
Yeah.
It's not about crashing into stuff and watching buildings fall over. It's about the monsters attacking each other.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of weird fake-out moments monster moves.
There's strategy. Because Megaguirus isn't as, like, dense as Godzilla. So, like, if Godzilla, like, makes contact, it really hurts Megaguirus. But Megaguirus has the mobility because it can fly. And so it's, like, constantly, like, sneaking up behind Godzilla when he's not looking.
Like, jumps on Godzilla's back. Godzilla uses his tail to kind of, like, swat it, which I think is pretty cool.
And then he uses his tail as a prehensile tail, wraps it around Megaguirus and throws him across.
I've never seen that before.
It's awesome. It's really cool.
And then Megaguirus makes like a final run at Godzilla with its stinger and wants to stab Godzilla right in the face.
Oh, this bit is amazing because it's going to stab Godzilla in the face. Like, oh God, this could be a killing blow. This could kill Godzilla. And then it flies the stinger into Godzilla's face, and the screen freezes like the ending of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, as if this is it. This is the end of Godzilla.
Yeah, there's a rear shot of Godzilla with the stinger going into Godzilla's face.
And you think, did the DVD skip? Are we stuck here? What happened?
Then the camera spins around, and we see that Godzilla's caught the stinger in his teeth.
Yeah, this is all a plan.
That much of a badass.
Yeah, and then
crunches
it
off.
Yeah. Oh my God, is that satisfying? That's really cool. There's so much cool stuff, and Megaguirus absorbs more Godzilla energy, and it can flap its wings so hard it can shoot a fireball, which I'm not 100% sure how that works, but it's awesome. Godzilla gets knocked down a whole bunch of times. Mm. He's really like, it's a good fight. Like, it's a legitimately solid, well-paced fight where they came up with a whole bunch of gags, most of which I haven't seen before in a Godzilla movie. This is one of my favorite fights. This is my favorite Godzilla fight I've ever seen. It's really one of the best, so far, anyway.
When it comes to monster fights, I like openness and clarity. I like when the edits are kept to a minimum. I like when the camera sort of stays back.
Yeah.
I just like being able to see the fight. I was on the socials and somebody was posting stills from the American Godzilla King of the Monsters, which is one of my least favorite monster fight movies.
Oh,
because you can't see any of the monsters.
Yeah, they went a little nuts on the dramatic presentation, but I want to see what's going on.
Like, so they're all like, okay, I understand you want to have like a volcano in the background, and realism would dictate that the air would be full of smoke because it's a volcano.
Right.
but it's a monster movie. It's okay to eschew a little bit of realism so I can see the monsters better. Don't cover them with smoke.
We're here to
film them in silhouette. Don't have them in the rain. Look, don't have them at night. Just have these big open fight scenes.
And I think it would be okay if they did that, like, once. Here's one that has a different bit of visual variety. That could work, but so much of that movie is a lot of obfuscation. I know you've complained a lot about Guillermo del Toro's Pacific Rim.
Yeah, I think same deal.
And I would argue that Pacific Rim does it better than King of the Monsters does. I think there's actually... I think the problem with Pacific Rim isn't so much the darkness and the lighting, because it's in a bright neon city. I actually think it looks really cool. Mm. I think it's the editing that's too fast. I think they needed to pull back some. And actually, even though I really mostly don't like this movie, but Pacific Rim Uprising... Mm. Kudos to them. Big monster fights or giant robot fights in the day.
Yeah.
And they pull the camera back enough you can see what's going on. I wish the lighting looked a little less flat. It looks kind of like Power Rangers-y. But that's the right vibe.
Yeah, that's the way you want it to. There was a scene in that second Pacific Rim where one of the characters had essentially like a buzzsaw ball.
Oh, yeah. It's like a mini...
It's like a vehicle they could drive in.
Yeah, the idea of their Pacific Rim is that all of those robots are so huge, it takes two people to pilot them, but they built like a mini one. Yeah. And they were able to pilot it all by themselves because it was like less complicated.
And it was like buzzing up the sides of people's bodies, like robot bodies.
Very
that, like,
cool.
That was a cool idea.
That was a great idea. Yeah,
again, I agree. The movie's not great, but there's some fun stuff in it.
Yeah.
Godzilla vs. Megaguirus, I like it because of the monster clarity. I like it because of the weird sort of sci-fi conceit.
Yeah.
I am sort of pretending that this is the same movie as Godzilla 2000. They're kind of going for the same vibe. It is the same looking monster.
They're not dissimilar. I mean, it's the same the same Godzilla.
And we're getting a new kind of relationship between Godzilla and the military.
Yeah.
The military has been a very generic force throughout the Godzilla movies.
Mostly, yeah.
They mobilize. They have a march. They fire weapons at Godzilla. It doesn't work. It never works.
Yeah.
It's rare that a human weapon will knock over Godzilla for an extended period.
I did appreciate the ingenuity of the Heisei era, where they were constantly trying to one-up their tech from the previous movie.
That was
fun.
Well, like, they were reflecting Godzilla's attacks back at him. There's the scene in Return of Godzilla, where they actually did knock him out for a little bit.
Yeah.
But it was never going to be the military that was going to save us. It was either going to be another monster, Godzilla would, or more importantly, Godzilla would have a change of heart. Godzilla would stop attacking on of his own volition.
There was a reason for him to,
In this film in particular, and the last one, the military guys were all cliches.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, we're going to fire a missile, crap through a goose, that kind of stuff. One guy has a line about going to Godzilla like crap through a goose. It's like, that is...
Admittedly, that's an American dub line. I don't think that anything like that in the original.
But
it's a terrible line.
I hate it so much.
It's a terrible line of dialogue. It's embarrassing,
In this one, we have this, like, sort of new sci-fi military force that looks at Godzilla with a little bit more respect.
Well, it's multifaceted. It's not just about killing him. They're also interested in studying him. They're also interested in all of these other things. It's not just, kill them all and let Godzilla sort it out, you know?
I think it was in the last movie. Yeah, because in the last movie they had... like a Godzilla scale, and it was also about a monster that was like absorbing Godzilla powers and turning into a Godzilla.
Yeah.
This one, same deal, sucking out Godzilla powers
and putting
it into another monster.
Yeah.
And in order to to show this, there's been several scenes of them picking monsters apart.
Yeah.
And there's a really gross, like, almost Cronenbergian dissection scene in this movie where they're, like, delving into a giant bug.
It's nicely
that's
tactile.
That's pretty cool looking.
Like,
yeah.
Because Godzilla 2000, I felt like they were trying to do so much of it, like, through optical trickery, compositing and such. It didn't feel very tactile. This one, it's got like a bunch of like CGI in it, but it's very tactile. They found a really good balance.
Yeah.
I think. They know when to use it CGI, and they know when to put just close up of a guy in a suit and then people holding squishy guts covered in goop.
And they say and somebody comments that it smells bad.
Yeah. Like all that stuff. Like that, it really
I wish people talked about odors.
That's something
in movies.
That's something that I feel like, because there's movies are a visual medium and they're an auditory medium. That's what they do best. They're visual first, and then we added sound to them, and that's a very important part of it. We don't get taste, we don't get smell, and we don't really get touch very well. These things can be very abstract concepts. Think of how many times you have seen a scene where characters in a movie or a TV show are in the sewers and they're not even holding their nose.
Yeah.
Or they don't even have a scarf in front of their sister, because that would smell literally like shit. Mm. April O'Neil maybe has gotten used to it after a while, but most people...
From the Ninja Turtles, yeah.
Yeah, the Ninja Turtles, April O'Neil probably the first time, oh, it's so gross, but like the 10th time she's like, I mean, it's gross, but I'm used to it. Like, you know, that kind of thing.
They don't, and they don't even comment. It's like, yeah, we gotta smell in a... live in a fart cave, but you know...
Yeah, like, that's the thing. Like, you need to actually call attention to these things, and every time a movie does that, it really helps put me, like, make me feel like I'm there, you know?
I love the movie Master and Commander, Far Side of the World.
Yes.
I got to walk around on the Surprise recently.
I'm so jealous of you.
They did a recreation of that ship back in the 70s, and that was the ship they used in the movie, for a lot of the movie. And they have it on display as part of the Maritime Museum in San Diego, California. Mm-hmm. So I got to go down there and walk around on the deck of the Surprise, and they have like TV screens up showing scenes of the movie.
Were you only at the... could you go down below, or was it only at the top?
No, you could go down below. Oh, wow, yeah, awesome. You could go down in the deck, and they had like exhibits down there. One of the opening scenes is all these guys in their hammocks.
Yeah.
Out at sea.
Yeah.
No fresh water to drink, but that's it.
Yeah.
Nobody ever once comments that this probably smells like curdled milk vomited an armpit. Like, it probably smelled, and there's like animals down there that they have to clean up the animal poop.
Nobody's showering, that's for sure. So you know?
It probably smells horrendous. Really bad. They never commented on the fact that probably smells pretty bad down there.
I was there's a comic strip, I don't think she does it anymore, by Kate Beaton called Hark a Vagrant. I think it's still all online. It's really wonderful. She does a lot of comics about history, like little quirks of history or literature. And there was one she did that was like two people in the Middle Ages, and it was a romance, and it was very sweet, and they're frolicking through a glade, and they're about to kiss, and he says, I have literally never brushed my teeth. Which sort of like, yeah, that would be gross, actually. You like, oh, I'm going to do this story where I go back in time, and everyone's like sexy and like, you know, living on the land, and it's like, yeah, and it's gonna smell not great. You'll get used to it, I hope. But it's not great. Do you remember when we interviewed Uwe Boll?
Oh yeah.
One of our first interviews we ever did together, it's long since gone off the internet, unfortunately, but it was you, me, and Uwe Boll, the director of such classics as House of the Dead, Alone in the Dark, and Blood Rain, and he's still working. It turns out Uwe Boll is actually quite good at pitching things. And when he was telling us about his idea for In the Name of the King 2...
Which hadn't been made yet.
No, he was about to make it and ended up starring Dolph Lundgren. It was a story about someone from the modern era being transported back in time, Army of Darkness style. But what Uwe Boll was like, yeah, but something they never talk about is you don't have immunity to any of those diseases. If they hand you a cup of water, they haven't boiled it first.
No.
This is like seriously dangerous, like just to drink the water. And so I want to do a movie that thinks about all of those things. And you and I are like, you know, that does sound like a good idea. That would be like potentially very funny or a real problem to solve. They mention it once and then it's never brought up again.
But as good as his word, he put it in the movie.
He did put it in the movie. It's not a good movie. Not a good movie.
He doesn't make good movies.
Not like, really, no.
I'd like him to get like a story by credit, but have other people write and direct.
That
might be a pretty good movie.
I actually haven't seen anything he's done in like going on 10 years. So maybe he's gotten better. I don't know. But my God. Anyway. Back to the fight. There's a few other things in the fight that I thought were really cool that we didn't get a chance to talk about yet. Because there's a lot in it. One, there's a bit where Megaguirus like throws Godzilla down, but like in like a building, and then drops a heavy thing on him, like with physics. And I thought that was cool. That was like a good. Well, it'd be like if this was like a boss battle in a video game. You'd have to like trick Godzilla into going over here and then drop the thing on him. It's like that kind of vibe. There's a bit after that where Godzilla gets up and he does one of the most human things I've ever seen. He shakes it off. He just shakes it off.
Yeah, the
Megaguirus, am I right?
The Godzilla actor in this film, He passed recently, if I recall.
Oh, yeah, that's not too bad.
Tsutomu Kitagawa is his name.
Okay.
Pardon me, he's still alive.
Yeah, that was a different suit actor.
One of the main Godzilla performers. Yeah. And he was very prolific, like, fight choreographer and stunt guy. Mm-hmm. Who was in a lot of different kinds of shows.
He was the Black Ranger in the original Power Rangers show.
Oh, was he really?
Yeah, okay. I don't know if he was the character or not, but he was in the suit.
You know? Okay, yeah, yeah. He was doing the stunts.
Yeah.
He actually... I feel like this Godzilla suit in this film mm-hmm. allowed for a little bit more mobility than in the previous film. Because, you know, this Godzilla, they tried to have him, like, lean forward a lot. And you can't do a lot of, like, human, like, body
acting. Are you talking about Godzilla 2000?
Godzilla 2000.
Apparently it's the same suit.
Maybe so, but he's moving it a little differently.
Maybe they found a better way. Maybe
they're just shooting it differently. I don't
maybe
know.
Maybe the director had better ideas. I don't know. Like,
in this one, he's a little bit more upright, like in the older Godzilla movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I feel like personality.
Yeah, and I feel like he's actually trying to mime a little bit and give Godzilla a different kind of personality in this one.
There's also a bit where it turns out Godzilla can jump. That doesn't necessarily happen very often, but he leaps into the sky, slams onto Megaguirus.
Megalon, there's that famous scene where he does that, like, flying kick.
Didn't he have an assist on that, though?
Yeah, but...
I'm just saying, this was just all in his own power. He squats, he leaps, rawr, jumps on Megaguirus. He's got Megaguirus pinned to the ground like a wrestler, and he's about to bite Megaguirus in the face, and he, like, brings his jaw down, rawr, and Megaguirus, like, faints to the left. And Godzilla ends up getting a big old bite of asphalt. All of these things are fun. I like all of this shit. So the humans are still doing stuff, by the way. Kiriko is in the Griffin, that big jet engine, basically. Uh-huh. And all of their weapons are broken, and they're just trying to fix it. They're trying to, like, get back into this fight. Meanwhile, Kudo is trying to... he's trying to fix the space weapon. There was some kind of power outage or something, and maybe that is where they're talking about the power thing, but it kind of comes out of nowhere. And all of their files are, like, corrupted. But fortunately, earlier in the film, he said, "Hey, I came up with this program that decorrupts files and uses a Nintendo Mii for some reason." And I'm pretty sure this predates the Wii, but it's the exact same looking kind of thing.
When did the Wii hit the market?
Because
I think it was after this.
I think it was, but it's definitely got, like, a similar, like, design vibe.
Yeah, it did.
Wii was 2006, half a decade later. Yeah.
This predates the Wii, The computer they're using, has this, like, little cartoony avatar of the user.
Yeah. So as he's, like, repairing all the files, this, like, cartoon avatar, which changes, like, it starts out as a nurse, like, it's healing the files, but now that it's got a lot of work to do and it's super badass, he reskins it. He has time to reskin it so that it looks like Kiriko. And now she's flying through the computer, zapping corrupted files. And it's so goddamn adorable how we used to try to make computers seem... We were so worried that computer shit wouldn't be exciting on film. And I'll tell
you
this...
It isn't!
It isn't! It's not! You'll notice that, like, you know, we've come up with some tricks to sort of just make it, like, when you type things now, like, it appears, like, in digital text, like, next to your face. So you don't have to constantly cut back and forth. That is so commonplace now. Mm. And they had to invent that. I think the first time I ever saw that was in Sherlock.
Oh, the TV show?
Yeah, that was the first time
The first time I really noticed it was in one of those really terrible Taken sequels.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Non-Stop. The one
I didn't see that one.
Where Liam Neeson
I did see that one.
And, like, he's deciphering people's texts.
Yeah.
And it just appeared on the screen next to his face. Like, why didn't you just do that? That's such a...
Someone had to come up with it,
at the phone and do all these edits. You just superimpose it on the screen.
I don't know if Sherlock actually was the first show to do this or movie to do this. I can't recall an example earlier. If anyone knows what the first movie or show was that did this,
superimposed text messages on the screen.
Just a brilliant move. Like, it seems so obvious, but it wasn't at first. Mm. Someone had to come up with it, and they did it in our lifetimes. Good for them.
I know for computers for the longest time, there was a trick where they would project what was on the screen onto the actor's face in a reverse shot.
As if the screen had, like, a giant fucking light bulb in it.
Yeah, like it was, like... Yeah.
Which, Swordfish is one of the worst offenders of this.
Which, I thought that was fine, just it's visually dynamic. I know that's not the way computers work, but I don't care.
I found it a little distracting, but if the movie's stylish enough, I'll let it slide.
And of course, the grand champion of this is the 1995 movie Hackers.
Yes.
Where they go into... computer files, and they just, it's totally abstract in that movie. There's all these, like, swirling images.
They're, like, floating around inside the computer, and, like, was it Ian Softly who directed that?
Ian Softly, yeah.
Pulled out all the stops, every trick he could think of to make computers...
Using computers.
The cameras flying around people.
There's a scene where they're in phone booths, and they actually put them on, like, a turntable and had them rotate, and they played all this musical montage.
Yeah.
It is visually interesting.
It's a very
good movie. Is good to look at.
I think it's a good movie. It's very 90s. It's certainly of its time. It's never going to feel timeless, but it's an excitingly presented movie. But then you get, and I think this is a little closer to what we're doing in Godzilla, but the tone here is so much lighter that I'm fine with this, by the way. I'm just amused by how retro it feels now. Possibly the single worst visual representation of computer shit. Disclosure.
Oh, I never saw Disclosure. That has like a virtual reality.
He's got to
put on
a headset and he's got to walk around inside the computer files, and the guy who built the program shows up as an angel and like, you don't know the right password. And I'm like, we are not there in 1994. Like, this is like, otherwise it's literally a movie about a sexual harassment case.
Yeah.
Michael Douglas is sexually harassed by Demi Moore, which, you know, at the time was like, could a man be sexually harassed? Yes. Yes. But then they just also had to make it sci-fi because Michael Crichton was big at the time. Like, remember when they did, what was that movie it was Rising Sun with Wesley Snipes and Sean Connery.
Oh, it's a terrible movie.
Terrible movie, but they, like, made this whole tech element very, very important. It's like, well, there's this video that shows this guy killing him. Oh, well, we can change video. See, I'm going to, like, take your head and put it on Wesley Snipes' body. And we were supposed to be in the audience go, wow. And to be fair, some of us did. Because that was still pretty novel at the time.
That movie
but nowadays
came out,
it's real.
93? That was a while back.
Yeah, but to be fair, that one is actually a thing. That one actually did come to pass. Sorry, all of that bit's all of that.
And in this movie, when they superimpose Mega Gyrus head onto Godzilla's body,
makes you think.
Wait a minute, that Mega Gyrus did that.
So I mean, Godzilla defeats Mega Gyrus, but the movie isn't over yet. Like, usually it would be like, oh, Godzilla defeated him, and he just fucks off, and everyone's like happy that the tragedy is over. But we're not done. Mega Gyrus is defeated. Great. We still need to destroy Godzilla. That's still the plot. So. Couple of things. One, Godzilla doesn't go back to sea. He starts moving into the city and tries to destroy, like, the Science Institute, which it turns out has been still working on that plasma energy thing whole time.
Yeah.
And Godzilla, I guess, only just caught wind of it. I don't know why he didn't do this sooner. But everyone's really mad, and they're talking to the guy who started the G-graspers. You switch the samples! You switch the samples! You can bring us plasma energy and Provasic.
And there's this weird space adventure now.
Yeah.
Where they have to what was it called? The dimensional.
The dimension tide. So the dimension tide is its orbit is decaying.
It's in orbit and its orbit is decaying.
So it's gonna fall down
to
the Earth.
This is like the walrus at the end of.
Walrus at the end of what?
Not Atragon.
Gorath.
Gorath.
Just kind of comes in towards the end.
All of a sudden there's this big wild new threat right at the end of the movie.
But I think this one's really, really cool. But this is absurd, but it's really, really cool. So the space weapon, its orbit is decaying. It's going to crash, even though it's in orbit, conveniently going to crash into exactly where we sent it up. It could have landed literally anywhere else on the planet. Keeps turning, you know? It could have been anywhere. No, it's going to land right back in Japan.
Whatever you launch directly into space will land exactly from where you launched it from.
Even if it's been in orbit for a few days. Whatever. Anyway, it's going to crash, but it's not going to disintegrate right away. We have enough time for one more shot. But It's currently plummeting to Earth, so, and the guidance system is fucked.
So we need somebody to pilot it during it, like, do a controlled plummet of some kind.
Well, no, no, no.
It's fire the weapon.
No, no, no. It's not that. It's, Kiriko, gets her ship up and running again, and she flies between Godzilla and the plummeting thing.
Oh, right, yeah,
so
yeah.
that they can target her, and then the idea is she's going to eject at the last possible second. So it's this whole, like, it's like that scene in Interstellar, where it's like we have to, like, link up to this, like, space station, but it's currently spinning at, like, 800 miles an hour, and this is, like, a mathematical impossibility, but we'll die if we don't at least try.
Yeah.
And then it works, because movie. That shouldn't work, but whatever, it's a movie. It's satisfying, it's cool, it's not my problem with the film. So it's this impossible shot, basically. It's like the Star Wars ending. Like, use the Force. Just in the nick of time, they shoot the weapon, and Kiriko gets out of the way, good for her. And Godzilla, who's in the middle of smashing stuff, looks up and sees his impending doom, and in a Hail Mary move, charges up his radioactive breath and fires at it. And it all comes together. The two beams meet in the middle and they explode.
Yeah.
And there's so much, you know, debris and everything. You're not sure if it worked. And then Godzilla's gone. Mm. Oh my God, we did it. We succeeded in all of our goals. Congratulations, movie. You reached where you were going to go. Two quick things before we move on. Little quick things that I thought were amusing. One, Kudo had been injured in an earlier scene, and when he goes to, like, hack the system to get the space weapon up online, his arm is in a cast, which makes it more difficult to type. So he removes the cast. And in movies, that's fine. You can
your arm is healed enough now. Yeah,
yeah, you broke it yesterday. No, he broke his arm.
They have plasma energy now. It heals bones faster somehow.
But they weren't supposed to be using the plasma energy. That was a plot point.
That's what made Godzilla so mad.
Oh, it was just healing his arm.
You're not allowed to heal your arms quickly. You gotta go at the regular pace.
But there was one other line, and I'm curious if this line made it into the dub, because I saw the version with subtitles. When the leader of the G-Graspers is sort of justifying why they kept working on plasma energy, he says, no, it was too lucrative. We couldn't turn it down. Mm-hmm. And then he says, but every country must have its secret research projects.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess kind of. It's kind of weird to put it that way.
Haven't you seen the X-Files? You gotta have secrets.
I guess.
Trust no one.
I guess the thing that weirds me out is the idea that that's sort of an entitlement. You know? Like, everyone gets one, right? You know? Like, it's like everyone has a porn stash. It's like, you know, everyone's entitled to a porn stash. I'm like, I guess. Unless it brings Godzilla upon us all, and maybe you shouldn't do that.
Ooh, that would be an interesting new twist if Godzilla attacks Japan because of the porn.
we could stop Godzilla's rampage if we just gave up all our porn. We will never do that.
Or maybe
it's not the way life works. Anyway, moving on.
Godzilla versus the porn industry. That's the next sequel.
The movie has two endings. The first one, Godzilla has been gone, but we need to be careful. Maybe Godzilla can find a way to come back. And so Kiriko tries to re-recruit Kudo, who I guess has gone back to civilian life. And at first he's like, no, no, no. And then he's like, I'm kidding. Of course I want to go. And then she, like, slaps him on the arm. Mm-hmm. He's like, you know, haha, but it's still his broken arm. So he goes, ah, my arm. And then she says, oh, I'm sorry. Freeze frame credits.
Yeah.
I think the idea is...
It's something playful, a little joke to go out on.
It's not really a joke. I think what they're doing is they're showing that she has, now that she's defeated Godzilla, and she's put, like, this, you know, mission, this obsession, like, behind her a little bit, and now it's just a job, she's able to connect with him on a more emotional, human level, a more sensitive level, and maybe they could potentially be more now.
They're friends now.
Yeah. At least friends, maybe more, I don't know. But, like, I guess it's supposed to be, like, a character moment. But more than that, this movie has a post-credit sequence.
Oh, I didn't stick around for that.
You didn't stick around for the post-credit sequence? It's not a lot. Remember the kid from earlier in the movie?
Okay,
so the kid is in school, and he was big on a bug collection, which you'd think would have been important, but not really.
Big bugs attacking, small bugs down here. Visual juxtaposition.
Anyway, the kid is kind of responsible for killing a lot of people because he, like, put that bug in the sewers, and we're not really going to engage with that. But the kid did call Kiriko earlier in the movie. I guess she gave him her number and said, hey, listen, I put all these bugs in the sewers. And she's like, okay, thank you for letting us know. Now the kid is back in school. He's doing school stuff. It's the end of the day. He's like, okay, I'm going to go put these things away in the school. And he goes into the thing, class, puts down some stuff. And then all of a sudden, he hears, there's like earthquake, and he hears Godzilla's roar, and he looks off camera, and he's terrified.
So Godzilla's back. Okay.
Godzilla is back.
All right.
Whether Godzilla found a way to survive, maybe going underground or something at the last minute, or Godzilla's energy breath altered the black hole in such a way that
changed it. Godzilla finds a way.
Godzilla always finds a way. And I'm happy he did, by the way, because dangerous, kills a lot of people, but this is one of the clearest examples we've seen of Godzilla performing a meaningful function. Like, he's actually trying to make sure humanity doesn't overstep its bounds and destroy the world with its over-energy. Yeah,
Godzilla is now a force of nature rather than a technological monster.
And not just a random force of nature, there's an animal fucking around. Yeah. He's got, like, a part to play in the global ecosystem in a way.
Recall environmentalism was a big part of a lot of entertainment. We talked about that with the rebirth of Mothra movies. Godzilla is a different kind of a creature now. Godzilla survives. When I see these monsters survive time and time again, I'm reminded of a line from Bride of Chucky. Charles Lee Ray, the serial killer, the Lakeshore Strangler, was shot being pursued by a cop, and in a last ditch effort to stay alive, shunted his soul magically into the body of a doll.
Yes.
And has been stuck in there ever since.
He's been trying to get out. Like, the first three movies are about him trying to put his soul into another human being.
Trying to get out of the body of this doll, but he keeps getting stuck in the doll. But he's also a murderer. Sells to kill people in this doll body.
Yeah.
Horror movie about a killer doll. Fine. And then at the end of the fourth movie, Bride of Chucky, it's like he's been killed and resurrected, always into another doll. And somebody finally gets the drop on him. He's in an open grave. He can't climb out. And they got guns trained on him. He's like, everything's terrible. And he's like finally looking up. He's like, you know what? I've come back so many times. I'll always come back, you know, that monster kind of a way. And then he just sort of like sits down and thinks to himself, but dying is so terrible. Like, dying is such a bitch. He has to just die and die and die, and he gets to come back, but then die again, and what a hellish existence.
Yeah. I actually love the ending of Seed of Chucky as well, because that one, they're gonna put his soul into someone's body again, and they're in the middle, it's a whole thing, they kidnap a real-life celebrity. Was it Method Man?
It was Red Man.
It was Red Man, that's who it was. It was Red.
It was Red Man, it was Jennifer Tilly playing herself.
Yes.
And they were going to, and it's all these rituals.
It's complicated, but they were going to put his soul into a human body. And then just before they're about to do it, he just only has this moment of realization, wait a minute, I kind of like being a doll.
It was like, this
I've gotten used to this. This is who I am now.
I've been doing this longer than, like, literally decades I've been in this doll body.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm just Chucky the killer doll now.
Yeah.
I don't want to do the... Yeah. I'm abandoning my quest to become human again.
I've been trying to become human for so long, I haven't even questioned it. And now I'm questioning it, and I'm like, what's in it for me? This is fine. I love being a doll. It's great. I get to, you know, stab people in the ankles. Anyway.
I do appreciate in that series when somebody dies, their last expression is always one of complete confusion.
Like, what?
Being killed by a fucking doll.
That would be a terrible way to go. I don't want to go confused. Like, that's got to be worse, right? Than just being killed. Like, you're killed by something confusing. Like, imagine...
What is that? And why are you killing me?
Like, imagine if, like, you know... if you're, like, you know, killed for the insurance money or something, it's very disappointing, but you're like... Okay, I understand the situation.
Uh-huh.
But if you're just going about your day, and then all of a sudden a lamp sprouts arms and legs and attacks you and strangles you to death, your last thoughts are going to be, what?
What is happening right now?
Is that a thing? Did I miss something? Does everyone know about these lamps?
I'd be more baffled than scared at that
right?
moment.
It'd be so fucking weird, right?
I understand you're killing me, but...
I'm very distracted by moments
like
that.
I need answers. In
any moment like that where someone would die confused, I'm very distracted by in movies. Especially if it's something that you could never have assumed would happen. Like, if you die and it's like natural cause, like a heart attack, it's horrible, it's tragic, no one wants it to happen. But also, people die of heart attacks. That's a thing. Or if I died in a car accident, I'd be like, fair enough, this would do it. Killer doll? I mean, I guess movies tried to warn us, but they didn't do a good job.
Here I am, about to be blown up by Santa Claus. I didn't see it coming. No, really, I didn't see it coming.
Anyway, Godzilla will return, but not this Godzilla.
No.
We're going to reboot it again.
The next one is another, like, very clear reboot, because it's actually a different design of Godzilla.
Yeah.
We're bringing back some classic monsters, but...
It's called Godzilla, Mothra, and King Ghidorah. Giant monsters all out attack. And I haven't watched this one yet.
Call it GMK for short.
I'm going to be calling it Giant Monsters All Out Attack because I love that title. Apparently, Godzilla is attacking and they enlist Mothra and King Ghidorah and Baragon made the cut. But they enlist these other monsters like the Suicide Squad to stop Godzilla.
Yeah.
And this That's a twist!
Godzilla has, like, big long fangs and silver eyes. Like, it looks like a vampire in the next movie.
Nice. Very, very cool. I'm very excited about that. But yeah, Godzilla vs. Mechagodzilla, I really like this one.
Yeah.
It's a good deal of fun. It works on its own terms. It's got a lot of, like, creativity. The visual effects are better than last time.
A lot of wild sci-fi stuff. I like the human characters a lot.
Human characters are better, though. A lot better than
usual. They have a light sense of humor and, like, conversation. They actually feel like human beings.
If they brought Kiriko and Kudo back, I would be like, yay!
Nice, solid one. Way better than the last one.
Way better. No. This is one of my favorites.
I haven't seen GMK for a number of years. Mm-hmm. I remember disliking it because they kind of changed things so wildly.
Okay.
But now that I know what I'm getting into, maybe I'll like it again.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Yeah. You know, we're all prepped. So anyway, that's it for Thank Godzilla. It's Friday. Thank you everybody for listening. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for if you're Godzilla. We hope you're happy with what we're doing. Hmm. And if not, let us know. You could be a guest on the show. You can give us your side of things.
You get an email. It just says, Skryonk, Skryonk, Skryonk.
Okay, well, shit. Okay, well, we're in trouble. He found us.
Skryonk, you're wrong about Caddyshack 2.
Everyone thinks we're wrong about Caddyshack 2. No one thinks... About one person who thinks we're right about Caddyshack 2. Anyway, thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with Godzilla, Mothra, and King Ghidorah.
Giant monsters all out attack.
I forgot the order of the monsters for a second.
GMK.
Stop it. Gunk.
We're going to be watching Gunk.
But if you want to listen to that episode right now, if you're listening to this podcast on our main free feed, we release all of our episodes of Thank Godzilla It's Friday 1 week early on Patreon. So if you go to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, for even $1 a month, you get all of our new episodes of our main shows ad-free, and you get episodes of Thank Godzilla It's Friday 1 week early, and you also get access to a whole bunch of other shows. At the $1 tier, we have some of our back catalog, podcasts about Firefly and the like. At our higher tiers, we have our really deep dives. We have our Oscars podcast, review every single movie ever nominated for Best Picture and Best Anime, not Best Anime, we'll probably get to that, but Best International Feature as well, and we're late on that one, and we're going to get to that soon.
That's completely on me. I just had a really busy time.
It happens. Really. Sorry about that. We're working on it. And also our Star Trek podcast, all our yesterdays, we're reviewing every single episode of Star Trek ever. There's a giant back catalog of that. That'll unlock right away. Thank you to all of our patrons. Thank you. Thank you so much for supporting us. You mean the world to us. We could not do it without you. Literally, we couldn't. It would not be possible. So thank you from the bottom of our hearts. And if you want to talk about anything we discussed in this episode, you can always email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Send us a physical letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90065. for.
Yes, and it's been too long since we've done a We've Got Mail. Let's try to do that next week as well.
Yeah, sounds good.
And of course we're on social media at William Bibbiani, at Whitney Seibold, at Critic Acclaim.
All that stuff.
But most importantly, let us never forget RAR. Or possibly Scryonk.